This is The Stark Truth, hosted by Robert Stark. Brought to you by StarkTruthRadio.com. Robert Stark is an American journalist and political commentator. You can listen to his podcast at www.StarkTruthRadio.com.
This is Robert Stark. I'm joined here with Mark Molyneux. He's the host of the Henry George program, hosted by Stanford Radio. Mark, it's great talking to you.
Yeah, thanks for having me on. Look forward to having a good conversation about this stuff.
So, just give us a basic introduction about yourself, your background, and your radio show, which deals with topics relating to urbanism and Georgist economics.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I have like hopped around from thing to thing. I've been involved with Stanford Radio for a good 10 years at this point. I think community radio is a really important outlet that I think not enough people get, to kind of have a non-commercial community hub that a lot of people can work on projects together. I've been involved with this for 10 years. I came to Stanford to be part of a structural engineering program, stuck around in grad school for a bit. I think a lot of things kind of brought me to the point of like looking into issues of housing, and affordability. I mean, I just happen to be here in Silicon Valley, which is probably the biggest nexus of everything being broken out there in the world. But on top of it, I mean, like, what makes you, you know, like, why should some dude from the middle of the 19th century really be very relevant? I think a lot of people kind of psych themselves out. They go out and they kind of look through like every Wikipedia page for some sort of like line of thought. And there's something really weird about Henry George. I think people who like good persuasive arguments, they get hooked and they say like, wait, this is dumb, but this is correct. I guess I'm stuck with this now. I think it seems like it, you know, it's very hard to stop saying like, well, I guess I have to advocate for this now, because it just really does seem correct, or at least deeply useful, except for the fact that it's a huge political lift, obviously. So it takes almost a spiritual weight with a lot of people. You know, this is something which is radically fair, which is transformative, but, you know, it's picked up by cranks, you know, so do you walk away from it and do more reasonable things, or do you embrace the crankiness? And I think it has a history of the people who do the latter, if they believe it's right.
So yeah, Georgists, they tend to believe people should own the value they produce. It's different than maybe standard left-wing economic theories that most people would think about when they think about the political left. But Georgists tend to favor, they support taxing land value rather than income. So can you give a sort of basic introduction to the sort of Georgist theories on economics and taxation?
Yeah, I guess I think it's important to say that Henry George himself, you know, is part of kind of the liberal tradition of school of thought. You know, he followed after Ricardo, Adam Smith, Mill, and so on. And he considered himself a radical. You know, he was unusual at his time for being concerned with poverty, saying, hey, you know, this is at once not good, because I mean, like, the middle of the 19th century, that was the age where people were saying, you know, it's God's plan that people are in poverty their entire lives, or like, it's good because of social Darwinism. And you know, to take that on, the liberal path up to that point, talk about like Cobden and other kind of liberal politicians, would be like, well, hands off, the government leaves everything alone. Everything will work out. And there's a lot of assumptions that go into that, which is saying, you know, that, you know, economic, you know, economics are self-regulating. Things will work out. You just have to kind of trust the system. And I think that even if you take that broadly, the idea of Henry George is, boy, land ownership really throws every assumption for a loop here, because land ownership at once is not productive. It doesn't do any of the good stuff. And this is not a new concept. Like Adam Smith, people's like Adam Smith, oh, invisible hand of the market. Oh, look at this guy. He just wants everything to be laissez-faire. Like he writes about how landlords were parasites and how you land ownership's not a good thing. So this is, it's not like everything was really novel, but he packaged it in a way that was really inspired a lot of people to say, yes, let's end poverty. It, you know, kind of kickstarted the progressive era. And I think to compare that to what traditional left-wing thought is, you know, perhaps, you know, in practice, it's radical, but it is not a radical liberal tradition. It's a radical leftist tradition. Insofar as different things, I would say, Marxist thought is more or less about how power works. Liberal thought is about how kind of ideas can expand to be generalizable and you can run society through. And I wouldn't say that even, I mean, if you can compare, George, I think, was a pragmatic person of his day. He kind of believed in, you know, you should have private property and, you know, you should have kind of just nations running things more or less as we see today, but without this fix. Some people have taken George's thought, like Tolstoy became a huge devotee of Henry George's thought, and turned it into a very weird anarcho-Christian, almost completely propertyless system, but with the core of, it's like radical sharing and kind of just avoiding all rent-seeking as being the core of it. But I'd say in general, the idea is if you look at the natural rights, insofar as this is useful, of how people get together, you know, if you work with something with your labor, you know, you have a pretty good dibs to say, hey, you know, I built this shovel. Hey, you know, I worked on making that product. You could take it a step forward and share everything absolutely, but it's at least extremely useful to say at least people who work on stuff should get their just return.
So when it comes to property rights, there's the Marxist view, which tends to favor communal ownership, or either communal ownership among the people or state ownership in some cases. And then there's the distributist who favor private property ownership, but with a wider distribution of ownership. So what is the general Georgist outlook towards private property ownership?
I mean, I would say the general gist of it should be you get private property insofar as it's not any skin off that anyone else's nose. It's insofar as if you hoard some goods, if this actually kind of gets you a return beyond it, this is bad. And this is actually kind of consistent with the kind of Marxist idea of accumulation. If you accumulate enough capital, this is actually going to put everybody else at a disadvantage and will have to work for your factories. I mean, in theory, there's no real inherent limitation to how much capital buildup you can. And that's, you know, that's positive sum thinking. You just make enough for everybody. But, you know, I would say, insofar as real communism, kind of if you imagine, you know, the utopian vision of Marx is, you know, from everybody according to ability to everybody according to need. It's, you know, running society like a family. I'd say in practice, can you really run a city with the same kind of absolute sharing you get within a family? Can you run a complete society? I think it's very pleasant to imagine you could run a completely sharing-based society, but I think at an urban scale, you have to kind of make rules, and that's private property rights of saying, yeah, this is your stuff, this is your stuff. As long as it's fair, you know, go for it. If it's not fair, something wrong has happened. So that's probably the general framework I think it has.
As for the whole efficient use of land, can you give some examples of wasteful land use and how to better incentivize usage?
Yeah, I mean, I mean, the worst example, if you go down to an urban area, a surface parking lot. I mean, there's a ton of these, and it's tragic to see.
I'm sure you see them in the like in the Silicon Valley on El Camino and like prime real estate.
Yeah, it's funny. Like you go down this is the most expensive land, you know, in the world in aggregate or something. I mean, like I'm sure Manhattan outtrumps it to a degree in Midtown, but you talk about Silicon Valley, incredibly expensive land. Every ranch house is $3 million. You go to El Camino, like there's like this old bar, like a barn that closed down, I think like 10 years ago. It's still sitting there empty with a sign up saying like, oh, thank you for your time here. It's like, this. Why is an abandoned old bar here? Then across the street is like a mixture of, you know, some abandoned buildings. I'll say this, I don't want to condemn mom and pop businesses, but you go down like a main street, like you have like some old camera shop that's open 2 days a week. It's like, you really should utilize this a bit better. It's you know, a lot of people who don't have the luxury of owning your shop and running it yourself as a hobby are dying out here. And, you know, people are using stuff wastefully. Every, you know, big backyard, I think there was a stat from like SF, like, you know, talk about three bedroom type you know, apartments that cost a lot on the market, but people who use them, and especially people who own outright condos or houses with more than three bedrooms, I think like two of the three are empty almost half the time, which is, you know, considering the amount of housing insecurity, how can you really justify empty bedrooms? It does give a bad name to say it's like everything must be efficient. You know, you make sure that you transactionalize everything and make sure everything is completely, you know, put to its efficient use. But, you know, wastefulness does harm people. And we, I think, need to kind of, even if it's your grandma's place and she has four empty bedrooms because she's lived there for 50 years, that isn't great. I think that from parking lots to you know, your quaint home, your unfinancialized, you know, granny's home. These are all different things that could be used better. And, you know, but I think you don't want to, you know, cause any suffering in any kind of transition.
Yeah, I saw that thing on, I was corresponding with you on Twitter about some article about vacancy, about the amount of vacant bedrooms for every homeless person. And the thing is, that's a huge issue in California because real estate is so insanely expensive. Like, I guess there's the issue of vacant homes that are bought up by wealthy investors or as a second home, but a lot of people, you might just have, like, as you said, like maybe one person or a couple and then like three extra bedrooms in their house. And the thing is, it's hard. Like, there's the concept of a vacancy tax, but it's kind of hard to deal with that issue as far as like the taxation policy without having like an overly intrusive government bureaucracy.
Yeah, I think that's one appeal of the land value tax, which is like you could have a bunch of bureaucrats look at everybody and say, okay, what are your assets? Are you using them right? Let's make sure that nothing is being wasted. Let me look to make sure you are not, you know, having empty bedrooms. Or you could say, if you are, you know, paying the community for the use of your private land use, you know, this is more or less a good heuristic for how well you're using your land. I'd say it's almost a perfect heuristic if the land value is assessed correctly. And I think there's some traps too. Like you talk about, like, you know, a lot of people want to make a distinction between like private property for like investment and personal property for use value. This is, you know, kind of a Marxist thing to say like, oh, there's use value, exchange value. And if you have empty bedrooms, it's like, well, as long as you aren't, you know, using it for financial purposes, there is no problem. It's your personal property. And I would disagree. I'd say that, you know, it's even if you are not an investor explicitly for the sake of making money, you can still misuse resources and really hurt other people. But I think it's a lot easier to say, well, look, there are ghost homes, there are ghost condos, there are places where billionaires are there for two weekends a year. I mean, I think those are just a lot more gross, and I think you get a lot more political will to address it. But, you know, I'm not really sure there's good ways to do vacancy taxes without weird surveillance stuff. I think they're usually done by the honor system, which is, you know, a good start, but there's a lot. I mean, right now people are, you know, trying to invest and then hide the fact that no one's living there. So I think you're only going to get more of that.
What are some other examples of how Georgia's policies can encourage better urbanism and reduce sprawl?
Yeah, I mean, I'd say if you are, I mean, the American way of how do you facilitate people living in cities without being overcrowded in slums? And our solution was you incentivize home ownership wealth by having middle class homes being developed on the edge of a city. Federal money goes into paying for highways to get there. So we do a couple things. You're kind of pouring money into highways, and then people buy them, and then as time goes on, they make money, and that's how you build a middle class. There are a lot of flaws with this. One is sometimes your middle class sprawl fails. Look at Detroit. Everyone's, you know, people are abandoning city blocks, you have like just huge empty tracts of places where people were hoping to have the retirement, as opposed to Silicon Valley, people have $4 million in a ranch home. So if you don't really get this weird like hold, you know, like sprawl and hold mentality, and if you don't get this kind of weird subsidies for sprawl, you kind of have to look like having self-sustaining cycles of, you know, you tax land, you put in the infrastructure, you tax land, you put in infrastructure. And this is a very good system. You know, you get things from, you know, Hong Kong to even Tokyo, just based on the general density, is able to have, you know, trains that make money instead of losing money. As opposed to like most sprawly type cities, they run a bus service at a huge loss, and then people complain saying, "Oh, the bus service is bad service," and you know, and then we lose a lot of money on it. It's like, well, based on the way you're sprawling out so much, you're never going to make this pencil. Everything's a trade-off. You know, if you put your money into running a bunch of bus lines, you know, you can't do it infinitely, as opposed to if you kind of make everything dense enough, you actually get infrastructure to pay for itself. So land value tax, insofar as getting people to live in denser, more sustainably financed areas, you can actually make sure that people get the infrastructure they need. And I'd say, well, what is good urbanism? You could say it's a bunch of aesthetic stuff like riding bikes. I would say it's about having sustainable, environmentally friendly, that's a human scale development. And I'd say Georgism, I think, absolutely helps things run in a human scale.
So how is the land value tax different than just the general property tax?
I mean, if you have like, you know, a city core and they're both very built up, it's like, well, you know, they might be proportional, which is like, okay, same difference. A lot of times they depart, you know, you could talk about like Palo Alto, right next to Stanford campus, has fairly dippy, ranch homes, but the land is worth, you know, $3 million. You see these like selling on Zillow, sometimes it's going to be like bombed out, just on fire. And they still sell for $3 million because like you're just buying the land, stupid. As opposed to what's the opposite of this, you could have a place where the land is valueless, but you know, you still have, you know, maybe 50,000 is the house. You see this in Detroit, you know, places where people are abandoning their lots, which means the land is, you know, valueless. If you're abandoning it, you know, it has no value, but they're still getting taxed on the improvements, which is, to me, is egregiously regressive. This is like the least amount of home you can have, which is like a $40,000-$50,000 home, probably less than that if they really take in depreciation. And these people are getting foreclosed on, but because they are, you know, the underclass, because they aren't the kind of good middle class people that, you know, the city council will, you know, look highly on, you know, these people are actually being kicked down the streets. And why? It's to have this house be empty. So I would say you could make the argument based upon like economic rent to say, oh yeah, extremely high properties should be taxed progressively. But saying your first buck in land and your first buck in housing should be taxed the same, I'd say is pretty goofy. And to say we should tax only land and not the structure, it has a positive benefit in saying, hey, you know, if you have a parking lot next to Empire State Building, you know, it's actually good we have an Empire State Building. Maybe we should have two of them instead of a parking lot right next to it. So it's pragmatic. I'd say, yeah, it's you could make some arguments in progressive structures, but it does the job.
So the purpose and goal of the land value tax is to incentivize that the landowner would fully utilize their property. But the one issue that I have with that is it doesn't take into account zoning laws. So if there were, say, more loose zoning laws, then say someone with a property, let's say like a major, like I was giving that example of El Camino Real in Silicon Valley. So let's say you had a strip mall with a big parking lot and really valuable property, and with zoning that would allow greater density, then a land value tax would encourage more denser mixed use walkable development. But the problem is under the way things are now, that doesn't take into account property zoning. So let's say you have an area for a single family that's zoned for single family homes, and you were to keep current zoning laws but simultaneously institute a land value tax, then you could end up just taxing people out of their homes.
Well, I think there's two questions there. One is, why are zoning classes so sticky? Why do they never move much? And two is about, you know, what do you do for taxing people out of their homes? And I question that too is, you know, the general idea is like, oh yeah, you should try to encourage the highest and best use. Should it be the highest and best use within the zoning designation, or should it expand beyond it? I would say, if you talk about, okay, what is the assessment on a parcel? Is it based upon the current zoning? If you say you can't build more than one single family home here, that limits how much the parcel is worth. Or if you say, okay, I can build an apartment building, then it's actually a much higher assessment. Here's another question. What would it sell for on the open market? And the open market would be, well, some people would buy it and try to upzone it, and they effectively create value by upzoning the designation. That's why a lot of people have problems with upzoning programs, because they say, like, well, you're actually giving money to landowners. You're turning their $1 million property to a $5 million property, and the community doesn't benefit. I'd say the Georgist answer is like, well, you do land value tax and you suck that back in, you capture it. But it is true. If you have a completely privatized, non-LVT system, upzoning is just a giveaway to landowners. So I would say that R1 zoning in a place like Palo Alto is extremely sticky, because you could say that it actually helps keep their land values low, but I mean, they don't care, because of Prop 13. Prop 13 in California limits the amount your assessment can go up. So really, you can just ignore the price of the land you're hoarding onto. So if it's R1 forever, you know, why not? As opposed to, let's say, we didn't have Prop 13. We did see tax assessments go up, because, you know, right now it's $3 million bucks in Palo Alto. You get a lot of homeowners like, well, I can't afford this. And at a certain point, there aren't that many people who can buy into it at this zoning designation. You will get people and enough political will to say, okay, let's make it quadplexes. Let's make it three-story, five-story apartments. Ideally, you'd see that. I think that's a kind of weak system for upzoning. I think we need probably more sustainable systems. Like, there's some people talking about directly using land value to designate zoning, which is saying, like, you should never have a single-family home where the land value is $1 million. That's just silly. The other question is, okay, so now let's say you do tax foreclosure. Do you kick people out onto the street? I would say, I kind of object to this framing, insofar as, you know, if you're a renter and you get evicted, you are literally kicked out on the street and you have like nothing to show for it. If you're a homeowner and your tax obligations go up to the point that you need to sell to pay the taxes, like, you're still walking away with millions of bucks. I mean, I can understand, like, oh yeah, there's still a lot of sentimental value. Oh, I hate to have my hand forced. Moving sucks. But like, of all the people who deserve the sympathy, I'd say the people walking away with millions of bucks are not exactly the high part of my list. I have a lot more sympathy for the plight of the landless in our cities. Is that something that you're concerned about? Is the fact that tax foreclosures put people on the street and that should never happen?
Oh, with tax foreclosures? I think it's if they're middle class, but then there's the issue of if they were to go up, if we were to do away with Prop 13, is it could hypothetically impact some people who are middle class, but the thing is there are these massive, besides just the whole issue of the revenue, there are these massive disparities, so there are people who are very wealthy who benefit from property taxes being frozen. So say they bought their home 30 years ago, and it's the current price is maybe $5 million, but they're still paying the rate that on their home that they purchased it. Then there's a lot of new buyers whom, let's say someone who's a new buyer who maybe bought a home that's worth for market rate that's maybe worth like between $600,000 to $900,000, and they could end up paying hypothetically just as much.
Yeah, I mean, you are saying like, okay, we should be fair to the middle class people. I think the question is, what do you do about it? Like, one answer would be like, you create generalizable safety nets and redistribution plans to make sure that everybody is helped. Because it's if we don't intervene to protect middle class, house rich, income low people, like, compare this to the people who are their next door neighbor who are renting. They're also low income, but they don't have millions of dollars in home equity. I just feel like the prioritization should be to help out the renters. Like I the people who invested in a large home and they suffered because it became too expensive. Like it's like I don't know. Like it's you win some, you lose some. You lose because you have to move because you can't pay your taxes, but you win because your investment paid megabucks. You know, that's not the worst outcome in the world to me. But I think it's kind of a thing too. It's like people say, well, I didn't mean to invest. I just bought a home. It's like, well, in America, when you buy a home, you're making an investment. Maybe you can say this whole system should change, but like, it's really screwy that we force middle class people to make the biggest investment of their life with putting a roof over their head. It doesn't have to be this way.
Another thing I've heard about property taxes is with non-residential properties, like one, there's actually some golf courses, I think primarily in the west side of LA or the central core of LA that are actually worth, if you think about like the amount of, if you were to develop those properties, like the amount of like $1 million units that could fit in, and then they're still paying property taxes on the rate of, in some cases of the 1950s or early 20th century.
Yeah, I mean, like even SF, you know, there's, I think, multiple public golf courses, which is, it's like, oh yeah, what's the problem here? You're benefiting the public. But it's like, is it really the best use of space to put a bunch of golf courses on extremely valuable land? I mean, I worked at a golf course back, you know, high school and college back in Cincinnati. And, you know, it's like, over there, it was actually kind of not that, you know, expensive. You know, I helped mow the greens on Sunday. And, you know, it's like, this is, to me, that's reasonable. It's unreasonable that you have golf courses in the middle of San Francisco because, boy, like, this is really expensive land. If you're going to use it for stuff, a golf course is extremely luxurious use of space. But what do you do about it? You could just kind of, you know, play it by feel and say, okay, you have government agencies that, you know, run their parks department. Maybe they should just, you know, try not to make golf courses in the middle of a city. I'd say that's fair. I think right now they're accountable largely to, you know, kind of wealthier people who enjoy the golf. It's also very hard to change stuff in general. You could also try to more like feedback signals. For instance, you know, I'm really impressed, like Singapore has a bunch of, they have like one land agency. So like Singapore owns the majority of the land in Singapore through public ownership. And then they have different agencies like their condos, the HDB program, the public housing in Singapore. They use the land to build stuff up. But it's not like it's one agency that owns it and they build their own land. the condo people have to basically buy the land from the land authority. But like, they're both Singapore, they're both public, but you still need to see the transparent movement of money from one hand to the other. And I think the problem right now is we don't see the money changing hands when you have a golf course in San Francisco, because the parks department's like, well, this is just free, as opposed to saying it'd be nice if it's like the parks department budget is, you know, 50 million bucks. They spend, you know, 10 million on it, on paying the general fund back for the use of land for a golf course. It's like, well, you can do a lot more of that money than use it on the golf course on a yearly rent. I think that would probably get better signal feedback, as opposed to, it's very easy to say like, okay, you know, this is just how it is. We have a golf course in San Francisco.
I know golf is really popular in Japan. I would be kind of curious to, because Japan, golf is popular, but they also have much more efficient land use. So I'd be kind of curious to see how their golf courses are designed as far as land use.
That is a very good question. I don't know, within the city limits of Tokyo, how many golf courses there are. Also, there's a lot of wealthy people that I sure would pay a bunch. There's also a bunch of good trains. It seems like if you want middle-class golfing, take a train out to the country, you know, hop down someplace that isn't so expensive. I'd love to look into that. That'd be interesting.
You mentioned Singapore. Do you know if Lee Kuan Yew was influenced by Georgism?
I don't think directly, but there is a line of ideology. I believe he was, I think you actually can find statements that he was influenced by Sun Yat-sen, and Sun Yat-sen was a huge advocate of Henry George's ideas. But if you listen to, like, Singapore had a bunch of announcements, like, late 60s, saying, like, okay, you know, as the land value goes up in our city, landowners can't benefit because they didn't produce that land. This is an unearned increment. And we should, you know, actually use this to pay for public projects. And, like, that is, you know, boilerplate George's thought, to say that landowners don't deserve the urban uplift in land value. And I think it's a – I don't see an indication that he was actually read George, knew about George, but I think by secondhand sources, he came to exactly the same place.
How is the housing crisis also a currency crisis?
Well, that's kind of okay. So that's something I was kind of saying, because I think it's kind of a goofy thought to say that we need to be doing more with currency to solve the way we think about housing. I think there's some parts of it which are true. I think if you talk about the 20th century, so much of what we did to fix macroeconomic policy has been to use the currency insights of Keynes. It allows us to say, I mean, the Marxist idea is, okay, you're going to have a crisis, and then eventually, capitalism will topple over. Keynes actually directly found ways that governments can intercede, and through fiat currency, make sure you never actually have a crisis. If you do it right, you completely self-regulate your booms and your busts. I mean, it's hard to do it perfectly, but at least offers a blueprint. Silvio Gisell, very interesting German-Argentinian economist, was also an advocate of Henry George, and had this whole system of free money, as he called it. And this was a system in which not only like Keynes' system can you have like the money supply grow and shrink to fix stuff. Instead, people get currency directly, and the currency actually depreciates. Like, you actually get the money, and then in a few days, if you don't actually get it restamped, the money goes down in value. And actually, because you spend time and effort and money restamping it, effectively means that the currency, you have to can keep on using it. So it's a way to self-regulate the velocity of currency to use it. Okay, to take a step back, to get back to my original points, the United States has one currency, the U.S. dollar, and the currency runs in the Bay Area, and it runs in, like, Wheeling, West Virginia, or it runs in small towns throughout,
Nebraska, Ohio, Pennsylvania, and so on, you know, Rust Belt cities, some which like have relatively high unemployment. Silicon Valley has such low unemployment that, you know, restaurants around here have signs of something like, now hiring, we need anybody to work here. We're, you know, they could raise the prices, but it's they're still pretty desperate, which is something you wouldn't see like at a place like Martins Ferry, Ohio, or where my grandma's from. So, like, what does the U.S. Fed do about this? They can, you know, kind of expand the currency and try to inflate it enough to stimulate this Martins Ferry, Ohio economy. But when you're doing that, you're also throwing more, you know, money around the Bay Area. So I really think you're seeing actual inflation in the cost of living, certainly real estate, in our hot metros, that you're going to get so much of that before you actually stimulate the backwater areas of the economy. So what could you do instead? This is a similar problem that we saw in Europe because, you know, they're the Eurozone there, and many countries share one currency. And this was a problem like Greece and Spain and Germany are all fighting on, okay, what do you do? Do you inflate the euro to help out Greece, make sure its unemployment doesn't go into crisis? It's like, and then Germany's like, no, that's going to actually hurt our, you know, inflation and so on. So it's really hard to share one currency with very different economies. A classic solution would be, okay, you have a large federal government that makes payments between, you know, the rich places and the poor places. This is one solution. I would say, is it really good though that Silicon Valley, you know, is piping, you know, wealth into Martins Ferry, Ohio? I'd say the forward-looking solution would be like, well, you know, Martins Ferry, Ohio doesn't really have a huge reason to exist. Maybe we should just kind of, you know, help people out and kind of, you know, living a, maybe it should shrink in real terms. I'm not sure. As opposed to what if the Bay Area, instead of being tied to Martins Ferry with currency, if it ran its own currency, you could actually have property tax be paying locally in a currency marked to like the Case-Shiller index of the greater San Francisco Bay Area. And then people are paid in prices that are commensurate with the cost of living here. That's a problem too. When people are being paid minimum wage, people have been fighting for $15 for minimum wage for 10 years. Now they're finally getting it throughout the Bay Area, and some cities are finally getting that point. And at this point, it's like $15 will not get you a place to live. And they're like, okay, well, $15 and we'll go up with the cost of CPI. But CPI does not keep track with the local inflation of real estate. So I really think if you're talking about, you know, you could do this directly by saying, okay, minimum wage is based upon cost of living. This is kind of an indirect way to to simulate what a local currency would look like. But I certainly think we don't do a good job at understanding how cost of living works throughout the economy, for many different types of way people live.
So for these changes to happen, would it have to be done through, say, the Federal Reserve or the Treasury, or could these issues be addressed locally?
I mean, I think to do it in the kind of goofy local currency way, yeah, you'd have to change. I mean, that's a good question. Could you? I mean, like Berkeley or something just a bit ago was, I think it's pretty goofy, but they were talking about like doing a Berkeley crypto coin to do something with local property tax or something stupid, which is like, okay, you know, I mean, no one's stopping you. A lot of people are doing cryptocurrency as a way to get around weed legislation because you can't do stuff with federal currency based upon DEA regulations, but California legalized weed at a state level. So if you want to like bank with it, you can create stable coins backed by the U.S. dollar, but you actually transact. So that's kind of goofy regulatory workarounds, but it shows in principle you can do local currency stuff in practice. If you want to, I'd say honestly using it as a mental exercise and saying, okay, instead, let's just make sure that we have a living wage where the living wage it responds to the cost of living, then you would actually, you know, see something more useful. But I'll say this would be incredibly unpopular business because you now say, okay, you want anybody to work for you? You have to pay them like $45 an hour. And this is just like well, that's not right. But, like, look at this area. You know, this area is so crazy, you actually had to pay that much to have a to have a local cost of living. And to take it one step further, this is more or less a reflection on the fact that, you know, instead of being paid for your labor in order to live in your area, you could cut out the middleman. Instead, if you live in an area, you could be paid with land wealth directly, which gives you enough money to live in the area. But that's a kind of big paradigm shift to say that everybody who lives in an area gets land wealth for free, but it is the Georgist idea. The Georgist idea is saying, because you live, you deserve to benefit from natural resources. You shouldn't have to pay the people who own them for some strange reason because of, you know, someone made a property claim, you know, 170 years ago or something stupid.
So we touched upon the Bay Area housing crisis, and a lot of people are opposed to building new housing. So as far as NIMBYism goes, there's a lot of different concerns and motivations and rationalities. So there's homeowners concerned that it would impact their property value. There's aesthetic concerns. There's the left-wing anti-gentrification activist. And then some people just have a strong dislike of density. What are your thoughts on those general concerns?
I think people are skeptical of change no matter what. You know, even if there wasn't an economic crisis, and cost of living crisis, you know, people are going to, you know, not want to see things change. And that's just human nature. And I can understand that. And I can say that even though I think I am more attached to novelty and I want to see things change more often, I can understand where people come from. I think it is unfortunate when NIMBYism is attached to just blatant selfishness, which is, I got mine, you know, forget everyone else. And if you don't have a plan on how everybody can live affordably in this area, I would say I don't care about your aesthetic concerns if you don't have a solution to make sure no one is suffering and homeless. And their solution is like, oh, they should move out to, you know, Central Valley. They should live in, you know, California City. They should go
I think I forget which politician it was, but some prominent politician actually said that we should build more housing in the Central Valley and Inland Empire, but there's not that many high-paying jobs in that area, and it's also ecological disaster.
Yeah, exactly. A lot of people, there's like one extremely weird, NIMBY running Rishi Kumar, running for Anna Eshoo's seat in the House of Representatives, but Ro Khanna, currently in Congress, he wrote an op-ed saying, it's like, I represent Silicon Valley. I think we need to move the jobs elsewhere, which is, to me, blatantly pandering to the NIMBYs who are like, we need less job growth here. And I would say, you know, I can see where you're coming from, but I think it is also very conveniently blind to the fact that people have allowed these jobs here because they pay for your government services. We have defunded the traditional cycle of property tax to pay for infrastructure, and instead people are living fat off of, you know, businesses coming in, hotel taxes, like, you know, don't tax you, don't tax me, tax that man behind the tree, as the old thing goes. You just want to say, like, I want to get government services but not pay for it, but also now I'm upset about the jobs because the jobs are creating issues with traffic and so on. It's like, I just think people are being not very thoughtful about how these all intersect. And I think when you say, like, oh yeah, I have a solution, go out to where there's no jobs and everyone should work there, it's like, it's just kind of something that sounds like a solution, which is just completely ridiculous.
Well, the thing is about the whole aesthetic concern is there are areas that can be upzoned, but at the same time, it is important. So both the Bay Area and the Southern California metropolitan areas, LA, Orange County, like it is really crucial to preserve the remaining wilderness areas.
Oh, yeah. I mean, insofar as we were talking earlier, I think real Georgism is anti-sprawl. I think you should not be ever digging into wilderness as long as you do infill housing. So I'd say if you say, please don't build infill in my neighborhood, I think you are saying, do the wilderness instead. And that, to me, is pretty goofy.
And I remember you posted some, I think it was some meme on Twitter where you were talking about El Camino Real in the Silicon Valley, and you're saying, like, in a Georgia society, it would end up looking like a Hong Kong.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's, there is just so much. I mean, it's a question, like, how do you pay for infrastructure? Hong Kong has good value capture, and they run a brilliant subway running under its main strip. Because I think, like, you know, you talk about, Hong Kong Island has, you know, one big strip on the north side of it. That's, I feel, very similar to El Camino being the lifeblood of Silicon Valley. And, boy, you have so much money. You have this one spine. We should be running a world-class subway, beautiful trolleys. And where's the money coming from? It's, you know, look around you. You know, the landowners are getting rich. If we just took this back, we could pay for incredible infrastructure. So it's just a travesty. Instead, we have adequate buses. I mean that don't run nearly enough and that are constantly, like, you know, having funding issues.
And I don't even think there's a BART proposal on that stretch. There's BART going extending to San Jose from the east, and then there's the existing Caltrans, but there's nothing proposed for that stretch.
Yeah, I mean, this is, I think, when you make a Santa Clara governments or whatever back in like 1956 or something turned down BART. And I think it's very hard to turn that back around. So, yeah, at least the BART / Caltrain loop will be connected. But, I mean, it's not great. Caltrain is being electrified. It's going to run more frequently and better. But I would love to see, you know, BART run as a complete system. But, you know, it's land acquisition and finding, funding sources is never straightforward, as opposed to, I think, if you ran more as kind of a holistic value capture paradigm, you'd say, oh, of course we need to run more subways because it's good for the bottom line. And I think you need that kind of practical mindset to make everything work.
Are the cities in the Bay Area that are friendlier towards building new housing, are they disproportionately lower income?
I think every place, you talk about, like, oh, gentrification. I mean, East Palo Alto is the only place around the entire area which is not extremely gentrified, and East Palo Alto is on the verge of going through gentrification. I mean, I think, Mountain View through Sunnyvale, all these different places, they like to pretend they're still a quaint old small town, but they're enormously wealthy in real terms. So I think, relatively, though, the places that are the richest are the most hostile. A place like Atherton. Atherton is where all the VC funds are all based out of, an extremely ritzy place. They have a Caltrain station that they've been trying to shut down almost because they don't want to kind of deal with the hecticness. They try to shut down the electrification process, and they, of course, don't build anything there. Palo Alto is not quite as bad as Atherton. Mountain View is better than that. And Mountain View has more renters. So I think there's two kind of variables you look at, overall wealth and, you know, are people homeowners? And I think when people are wealthy homeowners, they resist housing.
We're at the end of the show. Mark, do you want to plug your show and where people can find it and anything else you'd like to add about these topics?
Yeah. I hope I was able to answer questions and, yeah, in a way that was at all coherent. But, I normally just don't ramble as much on my show. I usually have guests and kind of try to pick their brains. So the show is the Henry George Program, runs on Stanford Radio and the website seethecat.org. It tries to be a lot of everything insofar as have a lot of housing people on because, you know, it's on people's minds around here. But I talk about everything from, you know, natural resources and other forms to having a show coming up talking about the history of McDonald's and its kind of real estate hustle. So it's, you can check that out and see what if that interests you.
Yeah, this is kind of off topic, but it was kind of interesting. I was listening to that show you did with that guest about Disneyland, and it was kind of interesting what you were saying is, because I've kind of noticed the same thing, is kind of using theme parks as an urban model, but also you also mentioned college campuses, and I mean you could even say there's interesting urban ideas from like the Vegas Strip, even with all the sprawl surrounding it.
Yeah, I mean, that is a big question too. It's like I believe that social ownership of our cities is necessary, at least for the, you know, kind of land wealth that goes down underneath it. But there's kind of a package deal. Like, if you believe in socializing wealth of a city, you believe in planning. I just tend to think it's very, very hard to plan everything at a top-down level and make it vibrant. I like chaos. I like, you know, fun disasters. And I'd say Disneyland is one of the few places where you get top-down planning that actually makes something that feels right. It's because they put the best people in the world working at it. Your average planning department, I think, are largely failures and not really like owning up to it more often than not. And colleges tend to do pretty well at kind of planning stuff out. But, you know, you look at like Brasilia, you know, you look at, you know, a lot of Eastern Bloc cities that are planned from top down. It's very hard to make them functional and human scale and work. And I think everyone says like, oh yeah, we can plan it right. And this is, at best, they imitate Disneyland. And I'd say, you know, good luck. I think honestly, what we need to do is just embrace chaos and a lot more fun stuff will happen.
Yeah, it's interesting the places that are not designed specifically for people to live. Disneyland is designed as a sense of escape. Some different kind of resorts, like you might go to like different ski lodge resorts where they're kind of designed, like a ski lodge resort might be inspired by like a more traditional village, but it's also much more compact. So if you go to like most small towns, they're still based on, you have these kind of like large, like 1 acre lots, and a lot of these mountain resorts, everything is very compact within walking distance. And you see that on a college campus, it's one of the few places where you can basically, you can get by without a car. So obviously people live on residential developments, but I haven't really seen that successfully that concept successfully transported into anything else. I mean, there is some value to new urbanism, but even new urbanist developments are much more car oriented than they claim to be.
Yeah, I think it's kind of like, you know, you don't want to make sure you eat your vegetables and exercise, but it's a lot easier to just eat snacks. And I think cars are snacks. You know, cars, they're empty calories. You know, you inject cars in the city, you get people around real quick. They just work. They're brilliant. Everyone loves them, you know. But the more you put cars everywhere, it just makes it so much harder to grow well, to do stuff, you know, and like, so you're replacing your city with parking lots. It's like you just have this big, ugly mess. Have you watched the Walt Disney video he made in the late 60s in which he introduces Epcot as being an actual city?
Oh, yeah. I think I have seen that.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting insofar as it's a bit antiseptic, but he tries to throw out every possible way to get people around except cars. It's like this big radial pattern of people movers. You have all these monorails and underground subways taking people from office park to office park. I'm kind of skeptical it would have ever worked in a meaningful sense. There's still cars you have in the exterior of suburbs to get around to other places. But, you know, it's a lot easier to say, oh, yeah, you know, you lay down some asphalt, you know, you connect people, put some parking lots, you know, it's good to go. I think there's kind of intermediate steps. It's that you have suburban developments, but instead they have golf carts and like what's that whole thing in Florida for
Seaside.
What was that?
I think it's called Seaside.
I'm thinking of a different one. It's like the I'm blanking on it, but there's I think a couple throughout the country, which is like, I mean, I still think it's a bit gross to have a bunch of interchangeable suburban type homes and big wide streets, but I think getting around by golf carts is pretty cool, honestly. I think it's a good I think we could probably like retrofit a lot of our suburbs with golf carts, because I mean, like, if you're biking, you get hit by a golf cart, you don't die. That helps, you know. It's like cars are authentically really scary and bad.
And I hear people talk about like regulating guns. People say it's like, oh, guns aren't that dangerous. Cars are a lot more dangerous, and no one talks about regulating cars. It's like, well, I think we actually probably should because, you know, they kill a lot of people.
That was Mark Molyneau from the Henry George Program. Thank you so much for being on.
Thanks for having me. It's been a lot of fun.